the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
When you think about it, on this program, we spend a lot of time talking about biosecurity and mainly about the nasty pests and diseases that aren't here, that are somewhere else in the world that we're trying to keep out. It happens when sometimes that barrier breaks and we end up with varroa mite in this country and its effects on the bee industry, or potato mop top virus in Tasmanian potatoes. It also works sometimes when we're talking and concerned about foot and mouth disease in Indonesia, one of our very closest neighbours. And a lot of effort was put into trying to make sure it didn't threaten harming our cattle industry and our agricultural industry by billions of dollars. Well, after all of that debate and discussion, it may surprise you to hear that we're looking at, well, loosening the regulations around imported flowers. We import a lot of flowers into this nation, and a lot of them have to be effectively dipped in herbicide, dipped in glyphosate, to make sure that nasty pests and diseases don't grow or don't continue to live on them when they are bought here for sale, particularly around Valentine's Day and Mother's Day, or just on the supermarket shelf. So why are they becoming looser? Why is there a proposal to loosen these laws? And what does the industry think about it?
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
Let's talk flower imports right now. The peak body representing nurseries across Australia is worried about a proposal to scrap one of the biosecurity regulations for some imported flowers. Flowers and foliage, including roses, chrysanthemums, carnations, among others, need to be soaked in herbicide before they're flown here. It's a process called devitalisation, and it's designed to prevent propagation and unwanted pests and diseases. Joanna Cave is the CEO of Green Life Industry Australia. She wants to see more evidence to support a Department of Agriculture decision to end devitalisation.
We are concerned, yes, even though we represent growers of plants rather than growers of cut flowers, we are nonetheless concerned that this important protection on a biosecurity basis is being scrapped, really, as far as we can see, on the basis of no evidence whatsoever. So we are very worried about it because it does have the potential, and we accept its potential, but it does have the potential to create unintended consequences and harm that could certainly impact the cut flower industry in Australia, but also other industries such as the one we represent.
How easy is it to propagate flowers that have come into the country? Can you do it if they've been dipped in glyphosate or if they haven't been?
The justification for the current devitalisation process is that it makes it impossible for two things to happen. One, for a cut flower that might be the dormant carrier of a pathogen, for that pathogen to spread, makes it impossible. And two, makes it impossible for somebody to effectively propagate from a cut flower. That's what the devitalisation process is for. It's to turn off those options. So if you remove that step, in theory, it becomes possible. There's no evidence one way or the other. There's no evidence that there were loads of people dealing with disease cut flowers and propagating or creating weeds, but there's also no evidence that they couldn't and wouldn't either. So, yes, removing that process does create a risk and potential unintended consequences.
If particular growers or just members of the public, keen gardeners perhaps, would like to propagate, they're in direct competition with plant breeders who have gone to the effort and the cost and the expense of going through the right channels and putting material into quarantine for potentially up to a year just to create this variety. So there's a financial disadvantage there too.
Yeah, look, removing this process does advantage international cut flower growers and importers of those products over our domestic growers. And our domestic market is highly regulated, that's accepted. But growers in Australia do the right thing, they have to, and they do that to maintain Australia's reputation for producing incredibly high standard fresh produce, including plants and flowers. So, yes, it creates a structural disadvantage immediately by changing this step. But perhaps more consequentially is what it could do for us as a nation if unwanted pathogens are able to spread and or plants that are weedy in the Australian context are allowed to spread. We don't want either of those things. And Australia works very hard to protect, you know, the fragile nature of the land where we grow things, and to ensure that we really manage very, very carefully the risk of pests and diseases and weeds. So it's a real shame to kip a hole in that armour on the basis of no evidence, as far as we can see.
I mean, are you putting a submission in, or do you feel strongly that this requirement as part of the review should be reconsidered?
We're certainly looking at a submission. I should say that we don't represent the cut flower industry as such. They do have their own representatives. They're close cousins of ours, of course. But we are concerned about the unintended consequences for adjacent industries such as commercial plant production. So, yes, we are considering a submission. We're looking, you know, in some detail about what's proposed.
That's Joanna Cave, CEO of Green Life Industry Australia, speaking there with Larissa Smith. We've contacted the Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry for a response. I'll read you that in just a moment. On the text line, there's this one without a name on it saying, how about just ban overseas flowers and pay local growers properly? Problem fixed, says that texter. I can tell you the department about the idea to end devitalisation, which is basically the process where the flowers that were going to be imported, certain types of flowers to be imported into Australia, had to be soaked in weed killer, essentially, before they could come here to make sure they didn't grow if they were a plant already hosting a nasty disease or it killed other pests and diseases on them too. They say, and I quote, and you better sit down for this one because it's quite wordy, the Australian government will never compromise on biosecurity. Australia's current devitalisation requirements are phytosanitary measures to manage biosecurity risks associated with diversion from intended use of imported cut flowers from time-limited decoration to propagation. The draft pest risk analysis identifies that biosecurity risks associated with diversion from intended use achieves Australia's appropriate level of protection. Therefore, phytosanitary measures are not required. Therefore, we are proposing removing Australia's current devitalisation requirements for imported cut flowers consistent with the principles of the SPS agreement. The department is engaging with the industry on the proposal to remove the existing requirement for devitalisation of selected imported fresh cut flowers, including a public submission process on the draft risk analysis. Clear as mud. That consultation that they're having on this proposal runs until February 17. So there's a bit of time there. Wonder what this means then to flower growers and the industry. And rural technology entrepreneur Nikki Davey actually won the 2023 Agri Futures Rural Women's Award, was the Victorian winner, then the national winner, with her campaign, Grown Not Flown, about the flower industry, trying to encourage people to buy more locally produced flowers. I wonder what she thinks about this. Nikki Davey, welcome back to the Country Hour.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Does the idea of easing what imported flowers have to do to effectively get into the country, does that make your campaign and message of Grown Not Flown even harder?
It makes it even more important, I think, which is any time that these conversations happen, it's great to sort of put a spotlight on the cut flower industry as a whole and to understand that Australia is heavily dependent on imported flowers in order to be able to operate. And so there is such an opportunity for us to be showcasing and celebrating the seasonal locally grown flowers for all of the different reasons, but in particular, largely because they're not having to go through those really, you know, strict biosecurity processes as part of it. So the inverse of that is also that, you know, if these rules were to be relaxed, there is also the potential for different pests, diseases, those sorts of things to also impact our growers within Australia and the crops that they are. It puts them at higher risk as well.
So in your mind then, is it a having a conversation with government, obviously, about the rules? That's what we've just heard about there. Or is it about talking about some of these issues and concerns you have with the wider public?
I think it's both. I think it's about us finding the right balance. I think it's about understanding what the risks are when we are importing the volumes of flowers that we are. You know, it's something around like 50% of flowers sold within Australia are imported, and that's a huge, huge volume of potential risks. And it's not uncommon to hear florists talk about opening or unwrapping a bunch of flowers and having a pest fly out as part of that. And so it's about us kind of understanding the risks with being dependent on those high volumes of imported flowers, the process that they need to go through to ensure that Australia is safe, not just the cut flower, not just the floriculture, but the entire agricultural ecosystem, but then also understanding the opportunity that we have to support our micro, small-scale, medium-sized growers that actually operate within Australia and to increase that demand for seasonal, locally grown flowers. So I think both things sort of need to happen in parallel.
To my mind, it can seem incredible that we'd think about loosening our restrictions on something like flower imports in a year where we've battled the spread of varroa mite, the potato mop top virus, which is affecting a different horticulture industry in Tasmania, and tomato potato psyllids affecting all sorts of horticulture in terms of restrictions of movements around Australia or in Victoria alone. To think about relaxing sort of further restrictions at a time like this.
Yeah, it can be really scary, and I think that especially with climate change on top of that, and there's so many different layers and nuances to the conversation that we do need to be really kind of mindful and protective of how we take care and of our industries as we move forward, and especially after we've taken so many massive hits in the last couple of years.
Are you worried about the biosecurity risk or the extra competition in the flower industry?
Not worried about the extra competition at all. Like, it's more so just around how do we make sure that our growers aren't impacted by this, and how do we ensure that we have a thriving industry and that we're not putting the Australian agricultural ecosystem at risk. And so I think it's just really about, like, how do we make sure that we're doing the best thing for our farmers, for our growers, for our industries, so that they can continue to thrive and grow, and how do we reduce the risks to those? And sometimes that means making sure that we do have these really strict biosecurity rules so that we're not introducing unnecessary risks to those businesses. If you're someone that enjoys flowers, just to be aware and understand the supply chain and, you know, that seed to stem to store to kitchen table life cycle, and where possible, ask where and how were these flowers grown, and support your local flower farmers.
Well, it's been good to talk to you today. Thanks for joining us again on the Country Hour.
Thanks for having me.
That's Nikki Davey, who is the 2023 Rural Woman of the Year and behind the Grown Not Flown campaign, but looking at the importation of flowers into the country and the risk around biosecurity. That's what we've been talking about today in terms of the end of the devitalisation process for some imported flowers, which is effectively those flowers had to be covered in weed killer to be bought here to be sold. Big part of, you know, the flowers that people buy around, particularly around Valentine's Day, Mother's Day, and often just year round in the supermarkets too, are imported flowers. So will these rules change bring greater risk in biosecurity, or is there something else behind it? I think something else is what Michael's saying it sounds like more than a touch of economic self-interest on the part of flower growers to me, says Michael. Do you mean in terms of importing cheaper flowers to sell themselves? Because often the businesses do both, right? Grow and import. Or do you mean trying to keep the flowers out? Sorry, I'm just not following which way you're intending there. I'm happy to read another text when it comes through. In the meantime, we'll continue to look overseas with one of our programs on the ABC called Pacific Beat, which does look throughout the Pacific and policies that are affecting there. This one comes from agriculture here. A hidden crisis unfolding in Australia's flagship Pacific Development Program known as the PALM Scheme, with workers leaving their Australian employers, with some saying they're in abusive and exploitative work situations. Some workers are now undocumented, unemployed and homeless, and many are now finding refuge in rural communities around Australia, as Lucy Cooper reports.
I was left with nothing.
It was supposed to be an opportunity to save money for school and support her family in the Solomon Islands. But instead, Susan Pienaar found herself in dire circumstances.
I feel, like, sad.
She came to Australia under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility PALM scheme, which aims to address labour shortages in rural and regional Australia. It's often described as a win-win, filling jobs in agriculture, meat processing and aged care, while providing income for Timorese and Pacific Islanders. But the scheme has been criticised for putting its participants in danger of exploitation. For Susan, work was inconsistent. She moved to four states in just 9 months, and her take-home pay was too low because of excessive deductions.
If someone like pick fast, they're gonna get everything, but if you pick slow, you have nothing. Like sometimes we're gonna left with $100, $200.
Susan left her employer, a labour hire company, and she's not alone. More than 7,000 PALM scheme workers have disengaged in the 5 years since 2019, a decision which puts some of them in breach of their visa conditions.
We heard all kinds of stories from people who'd left the PALM scheme, some really harrowing accounts of, you know, abuse and exploitation.
Dr. Kaya Barry is from Griffith University. She's among researchers from three universities who have put out a new report looking at the work and living conditions of disengaged workers.
We saw several pay slips that people showed us where they'd receive like zero take-home pay, like zero net pay. They're largely being exposed to situations that are equivalent to modern slavery. So they have no legal status in Australia. That means they have no support for Medicare, for work cover, for any kinds of rights that everybody else either on a temporary visa or an Australian citizen has.
She said PALM scheme workers arrive with visas tying them to one employer, and they face barriers to changing jobs if they encounter problems at work.
A lot of the workers that we've spoken to have felt that they were just unable to ask for changes, whether that's changes just to the role or the kind of work they're doing, or changes to their location in where they work.
One former PALM worker, Wayne Levy, left his employer, a labour hire company, over concerns about excessive deductions and low pay.
There is no transparency regarding our payment. We don't know what's going on. All the deduction, we don't know what we deducted for. At the end of the day, I just received, let's say, 200 and 300. So I can't support my family. I have kids back home and they have to attend their education and I have to plan, I have to meet for the future. So when I receive this sum of money, you know, it's like a pain in my body.
He's since gained a bridging visa, which allows him to work on a citrus farm.
See, this is a good opportunity. I come and show the citrus farm here. It's a good money here.
He ended up in the New South Wales riverina town of Leeton.
I love Leeton. I want to stay here for the whole of my life. If I can get my family here too, would be great, yeah.
The sun-drenched horticultural hub is home to fruit and rice-growing industries that fill supermarket shelves across Australia. It's here that community leaders have seen an influx of workers looking to make ends meet.
People aren't becoming disengaged here in Leeton. They're disengaged before they come to Leeton. So they come here seeking friendship, connections, and some opportunities to work.
Paul Matem leads the town's multicultural support group. He also served as the local mayor for 16 years.
We can't walk away when we see people that maybe haven't been treated fairly. They don't really know where to go. They're frightened. They don't have any real connection. So we fill that gap.
He was pivotal in creating the reputation Leeton has today, one of acceptance and safety.
We don't have a brick wall around our town, and we never will. There'd be a huge void if suddenly they all had to go home.
Do you get paid for the work that you do?
No.
Why do you do it?
Well, in a nutshell, I care. So I care about people, and I certainly feel that I have an obligation. And certainly when I retired from mayor, I certainly didn't retire from care.
Susan Pienaar didn't return home after leaving the PALM scheme. Her family needed financial support and she feared violence from someone she knew back home. She too found herself in Leeton after forming a relationship with a former PALM worker and falling pregnant. Soon after giving birth to her daughter Angela, there was a breakdown in the relationship.
And that time, like, after everything, I feel like commit suicide.
She found support from a Leeton family who gave her accommodation and community workers who helped her obtain a bridging visa, letting her study aged and disability care.
That's bring me like, that's comfort bring me like, oh, I'm someone.
Paul Matem said many former PALM workers who are pregnant go months without medical care.
The worst case I've seen is one woman 8 months pregnant that's never been to a doctor, remembering they've got no health cover. They've got nothing there to give them any cover, so they just turn up.
Leeton Mayor George Weston is proud of the culture Leeton has, but warns everything has a tipping point.
We go out our way to try and help these people, and it's not a burden. It can be a burden if it left for go too long. If more and more people come here, we need really help from the federal government, you know, to help us with these people who've been disengaged to back into working again.
That's Leeton Mayor George Weston ending that report for Lucy Cooper. And look, if that raised anything for you and you want someone to talk to about it, Lifeline's there for you. 13 11 14 is their number, and you can save that in your phone if you ever do need it in a future day. 13 11 14. You're listening to The Country Hour. Warwick along with you. We're going to do something slightly different because the Agriculture Minister is meant to call in 5 minutes' time. So with that in mind, we might go to rural news a little early and then come back with the Agriculture Minister before we go to the weather. Sorry for the jumble, but, you know, sometimes you need to make these things fit. Justine Longmore has rural news for you today. Hello there, Justine.
Good afternoon, Woz. A farmer dealing with a bushfire that threatened her property at Bulladela on the New South Wales mid-north coast at the weekend has been left shocked by the theft of one of her sheep during the emergency. Merino sheep farmer Julie Steep was anxiously monitoring the situation at her 40-hectare property on the Pacific Highway right on the edge of the fireground where she had her 32 sheep. Despite live embers falling on the property, Ms. Steep's farm wasn't damaged, but she says she discovered one of her sheep was missing and two others were injured.
Literally, we had the by the time I found out the fire was started to the time it was a complete emergency, we're talking hours. So I had left my property for a little bit, and in that time, somebody's come into my farm and chased my sheep that were already stressed and attempted to catch a number of them. I found one with baling twine slip knotted around her back leg. She managed to escape. I found another one that was so run to death, basically. She was still alive, but I went down to put her down on Saturday afternoon when I found her. Another sheep was stolen completely, just gone.
Grain storage and handler GrainCorp says Victorian farmers have ramped up their harvest activities in the past week. Nearly 500,000 tonnes of grain was delivered to GrainCorp sites, taking the total so far this harvest to 1.2 million tonnes. GrainCorp says in Victoria, growers have gained momentum after several weeks of wet weather, with wheat, barley and canola receivables coming in. They said clearer conditions over the coming weeks should support further progress, with harvest activities expected to continue into the festive period under favourable conditions. New South Wales farmers have so far delivered 4.6 million tonnes of grain to GrainCorp and Queenslanders 1.5 million tonnes. The US President Donald Trump is offering $12 billion in support to farmers in the United States. American farmers have lost markets and many say they are struggling to make ends meet after the US tariff policy changed the flow of agricultural trade around the world. Mr. Trump says some of the money collected by his tariff policy will go to one of the industries most affected by it.
I'm delighted to announce this afternoon that the United States will be taking a small portion of the hundreds of billions of dollars we receive in tariffs. We are making a lot of money from countries that took advantage of us for years. They took advantage of us like nobody's ever seen. Our deficits are way down because of tariffs. So what we're doing is we're taking a relatively small portion of that and we're going to be giving and providing it to the farmers in economic assistance. And we love our farmers. And as you know, the farmers like me, because, you know, based on voting trends, this relief will provide much needed certainty to farmers as they get this year's harvest to market and look ahead to next year's crops, and it'll help them continue their efforts to lower food prices.
The Euroa Arboretum has received a grant of up to $900,000 over 3 years to help make more native seed orchards across the Goulburn-Murray catchment. and it couldn't have come at a better time. The demand for native species is continuing to grow, while the statewide seed supply remains very low. Kath Olive, the development manager at the Euroa Arboretum, says they are thrilled to receive the grant.
We have really poor facilities for our seed storage and harvesting. Well, not storage. We have our seed is stored in a cool room, but our shed facilities are pretty basic, pretty rudimentary. And come this time of year when seed harvest is on, they are absolutely to the gunnels. So the funding will help us to build a new seed store. So we'll have a big shed to be able to put out all of our seed to dry as we're harvesting. It'll be great for storage. So we're really looking forward to that. We'll have a little office as well. So that's fantastic. Plus, and this is a really big win, we'll add another 32 hectares worth of seed orchards to the orchards we've already got.
And that's all for Rural News today.
Thanks very much for that, Justine Longmore with Rural News for you. Tomat Winslow, just on that earlier story about Labor Hire Companies, says, was if these Labor Hire Companies that are ripping off Pacific Islanders can be identified, they should be locked up, .. for a considerable time. What a pack of parasitic, I think I can say it, Tom, bastards, says Tom on the text line 0467 842 722 if you want to send us a text here on the country. Coming up, weather. After that, you're going to meet somebody called the Steer Whisperer. I don't know if I should be whispering that, the Steer Whisperer. We'll find out together. That's coming up here on the Country Hour. In the meantime, the National Food Council has met for the first time, an important group that's looking at Australia's food security at a national federal government level. To tell us more about it, the Agriculture Minister, Julie Collins, can join you for a few minutes on the line. Julie Collins, welcome back to the Country Hour.
Good afternoon, Warwick, and good afternoon to your listeners today.
What is the National Food Council trying to do?
Well, what we want to do is work on Australia's first national food security strategy, Feeding Australia. We do know that some of the states and territories, and certainly internationally, a lot of countries have a food security strategy. This is a first for Australia, though. We've not done this before. So what we've got is we've got a skills-based board, around 11 people on it. I think 10 of them were at the meeting yesterday when we had our first meeting, where we're looking at Australia's food system from inputs to production to our farming and farmers and production, all the way along the supply chain to the end consumers to have a look at our food system. We obviously have great safe food in Australia. What we want to do is make sure that we have that available in the future and make sure that our food system is strong and robust for any of the threats that might come at it, whether that be things like biosecurity, whether it be climate change or a whole range of things.
Yeah, so what's food security? Is it the ability to produce food? Is it having enough in times of conflict? Is it having enough in times of a shock like COVID? What's food security to the government?
Well, that's what we were talking about yesterday, actually, Warwick, was a discussion about how are we going to measure success? What are we going to measure? What is food security? How do other nations do it? And what sort of data are we going to collect around food security? So we're at the initial discussion stages of that. Certainly the things that Australians tell us they want is convenience, obviously, price and safety are really, really important, and sustainability of the system is also important. So what we want to do is have a look at that entire food system, have a look at the weaknesses in it and the threats to it and the risks to it, and then say, okay, well, can we mitigate those? Should we mitigate them? Are the mitigations cost effective, and who should bear the costs of that mitigation, or is this a joint thing that we're all going to have to share together?
So what are the priorities then?
What sort of priorities are that?
What was identified yesterday?
Yeah, so as I said, we're at the initial stages of that. So we're having a look at, you know, what are the things in terms of input to production? Well, they're obviously people in terms of skilled labour. There are obviously things like fuel and fertiliser and chemicals and things that we need that Australia doesn't produce in terms of sovereign capability. Can we, are there any of those things or risks to those supply chains that we need to mitigate? Things like, you know, we're going to make sure that we have enough perishable, nutritious foods that people need to eat every day. Are they affordable? Are they affordable equally to all Australians was discussed. We were discussing, you know, our food manufacturing system. We're also talking about the future of our food security, like, you know, we're talking about today, but where do we want to be in 10 years and 20 years' time? As our food security system has got to be agile enough to be able to get us there with changes to technology and AI and all the different innovations that are going to come between now and then. and how do we make sure that, you know, we do have convenient food that's safe and affordable for the vast majority of Australians. But importantly, as a trading nation, we also export around 70% of it because we're fortunate that we can produce enough food for Australia several times over, is as we are also feeding our global neighbours and how important that is to the nation's national security too. So there was a very broad ranging discussion yesterday, and as I said, we're at the initial stages. This will take around 2 years to develop. So this was a first very robust discussion that we had yesterday. As I said to the members of the council yesterday, I do expect that we'll have some very strong opinions, and sometimes we won't all agree, and that's a very good thing. Like, if we've got some debate and discussion around some of the topical issues, then that's a good thing because it means our food security strategy has been tested and is robust. There'll be lots of discussions and consultations with experts in various fields as we go about developing this strategy, and we want to take the time to make sure we get it right.
And it'll be really interesting to see how that process goes from here. I've got to go to the weather in just a couple of minutes, but before I go, I've got a stack of paper in front of me from people criticising who you've put on this food council. The Australian Agroecology and Food Sovereignty Alliance say this shows that the food industry is captured by corporate greed. I've got a Uni of Adelaide health expert saying it shows that you're not showing enough public health considerations in a food instance. I've got a group of farmers saying there's no real farmers on this board. And I've got another one saying there are too many ag manufacturing industry reps. That's from Rachel Carey from the University of Melbourne. Has a lot of that criticism about who you've chosen for this made it to your desk?
Well, obviously, I'm aware of those public comments, and we had a bit of a discussion about it yesterday. And certainly, as I said, it's a skills base. We do have people representing all of those different groups and interests that you talked about. But frankly, Warwick, I think it's a fabulous thing that we have so many people interested in this food strategy and the fact that we are discussing having a food strategy for the first time. There'll be ways for people to have their input. We've already had a discussion paper out, which had well over 300 submissions. In terms of the Food Council itself, that was, again, a public expression of interest, over 100 people. The department went through a skills matrix of the skills and expertise we need on this council. We did a bit of a correlation of that. There were interviews undertaken. It's been a pretty robust decision to get to the council membership to where we are today. And I think everybody on it brings some amazing expertise to the table. Does that mean we've got every skill and every expert that we need at the table? No, otherwise it would be just unwieldy and too large, but we will be consulting with various experts in various areas as we go along and develop this strategy.
Well, it's been good to talk to you again, Julie Collins. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks very much, Warwick.
Julie Collins, who is the Federal Agriculture Minister, speaking to you here on The Country Hour. The first meeting of the National Food Council, looking at Australia's biosecurity and food security future, mainly food security. I think I just accidentally added biosecurity there because we've been talking about that earlier in the show. Looking at food security and what that means, identifying what that means is a really big question, right? So that's a really important one to ask. But then also having a look at the future and what this means and who's on it. I think we'll be talking about that for another year or so together, won't we?
The Country Hour. Celebrating 80 years in 2025.
Hi, I'm Darren Maddock, farming at Barranduda. Sheep and cattle, our biggest livestock is our compost worms though. Yeah, we've got a large worm farm here at Barranduda. We've got many millions of composting worms that we produce liquid and solid fertiliser from. I listen to the Country Hour from as long as I can remember. Knee-high to the grasshopper. Love it. Well, when the cattle prices boomed, I was pretty excited a few years ago. I listen to the Country Hour, I enjoy the diversity, the entertainment, always keeps me up to date with what's happening in rural Victoria and Australia. Happy birthday to the Country Hour.
80 years of the Country Hour, Australia's longest running radio show.
Text here saying Australia needs a urea plant. We've spent a lot of time talking about that, and I think we'll talk about that in the consideration of this food plant. Let's go to Michael Efron. I am late in getting to the bureau, so let's go there right now. G'day, Michael.
G'day, Warwick.
How are we looking around Victoria this lunchtime?
Yeah, pretty settled today with southerly winds, keeping temperatures a bit below average in the south. Across the north, still pretty warm, pushing into the low to mid 30s today, but for those southern areas, tops in the high teens or low 20s. Seeing reasonably cloudy conditions through East Gippsland, but elsewhere partly cloudy or mostly sunny skies, and really settled conditions generally today. But as we push into Wednesday, we are going to see some mid-level cloud moving through the state, and that could produce some patchy light rain generally around the ranges during the day on Wednesday. I don't think we'll see more than a few millimetres out of that. The north and the far south should stay mostly dry. In terms of those temperatures, again, quite a difference from north to south. In the south, high teens to low 20s again, high 20s to low 30s for the north. So fair bit of difference there on Wednesday. On Thursday, we see that cloud moving away. However, we will see some afternoon showers and storms developing over the eastern and northeastern ranges during Thursday afternoon and evening. Elsewhere, really settled conditions. We are looking at the low to mid-20s in the south, high 20s to low 30s across the north, even the mid-30s in the Mallee. Then looking ahead to Friday, we do see a low-pressure trough remaining across the state, so that will produce showers and thunderstorms during the afternoon and evening over eastern districts, dry elsewhere, quite warm through the northwest. We're looking at tops there around 36 or 37. Elsewhere in the north, looking at tops in the low to mid-30s, and then in the south, mid to high 20s, so starting to warm up towards the weekend. Then as we head into Saturday, we do see that low-pressure trough crossing central and eastern districts. So central and eastern Victoria, looking at some showers and storms on Saturday during the morning, then contracting into eastern areas into the afternoon and evening. Winds will shift cooler southwesterly from the west as well. So we'll see temperatures in the north in the high 20s or low 30s. In the south, looking at the low to mid 20s. In the southwest, a little bit cooler with that change arriving earlier. Potentially some moderate falls over eastern and northeastern districts with those showers and storms moving through. And then for Sunday and Monday, we'll see that cool southwesterly flow across the entire state. So for the south, looking at the mid to high teens, across the north, mid 20s, even low 30s through the northwest. Partly cloudy in the south with isolated showers, dry and mostly sunny across the north. And then next Tuesday, we'll start to warm up with that high pushing towards Bass Strait, and we'll see temperatures pushing into the mid-30s across the north, but really not too much happening over the next few days. I think Friday into Saturday, the most active conditions, especially over eastern and northeastern Victoria.
I don't think Craig's going to be too happy with that, saying, can you ask the bomb how much rain for the Indigo Valley? So we're looking northeast there on Saturday. The millets come up, but it needs a good rain to really get going. What's Craig going to expect there, Michael?
Yeah, so Friday into Saturday, I think we'll see around 5 to 15 millimetres in that region, but under a thunderstorm could see locally 15 to 30, so potential for some higher falls in that region.
So there could be something. I suppose there's hope there. And warnings-wise, is it only sort of wind warnings, or is there off the coast, or is there much more over the next 24 hours or so?
Not even wind warnings, no. Very settled. No warnings current, but we will be watching those thunderstorms towards the end of the week, potentially some warnings for those.
Well, we'll take at least some period of time without warnings. Michael Efron, thanks very much for the update.
Thanks, Warwick.
Michael Efron then, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology. Getting to him a little bit late because the Ag Minister wanted to call in at 12:30. We made that happen for you to give you a bit of information about the National Food Council, which is having a meeting, but as you heard, 2 years worth of process, so there could be more to come here. Let's go out onto the farm, but maybe looking at it in a very different way, not talking about sonar, but maybe using light waves to build a 3D model. The light detection and ranging technology, or LIDAR, has been used in research from Charles Sturt University to make a sophisticated map of the Murray-Darling Basin. Charles Sturt University Earth Science Professor Andrew Hall says fine-scale mapping of the river system will allow for precise decision-making to try and sustain wetlands.
and it just measures the amount of time it takes for one pulse to go out and then come back. It's pointed very accurately, so it knows exactly its place in space and the direction at which that light pulse is being sent out. The amount of time it takes for it to come back is recorded, and then it takes hundreds of thousands of those are pulsed out every second. So we've got this very good equipment now that can do that. And using that information, all of that information goes into a computer, and it can produce a three-dimensional model of whatever you're shooting it at. In a remote sensing sense, of course, you're flying in an aeroplane often. You've got a good LiDAR device, and it's shooting down at the ground. The plane's moving, of course, as well. All of that is taken into account by the mathematics in the computer system, and then it builds up a three-dimensional model.
It sounds a bit like echolocation.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. So obviously, echolocation, you use a pulse that tells you how far away something is from you. But this system, obviously, it can do hundreds of thousands of pulses every second, so it can produce this really accurate three-dimensional model.
How is that being used to impact water delivery?
It is used extensively to produce, detailed models of the topography of the landscape. And in an Australian and water resources management context, we produce very high resolution models of river basins and floodplains. And that gives us a really good idea of the geomorphology, the river basins. And then we can use that to model the flow of the water through a system.
How does that impact the outcomes for the environment?
Because of the complex topography, and they are very large systems, the river valleys, the area that I work in, obviously the Murray-Darling Basin, we need the information about those to manage the water through those systems. So having the best information we have available about the bathymetry of these systems. So bathymetry is just basically underwater topography. If you do your LiDAR remote sensing at a time when the system is quite dry, you can look at the topography, because LiDAR doesn't really work underwater. That's where you do use sonar. But if you do it during a dry period, then you can get the shape of the wetland systems when they're dry, and that will give you a really good idea of what's happening to water when it comes into the system. The environmental benefits of managing the limited environmental water that we have, because obviously there's a lot of abstraction used for agricultural productivity, which is very important. We want to manage the water that we have available for the ecology in a way that maximises the benefit to ecosystems. So, for example, we want to, during dry periods, we want to maintain refuges. So we want to be able to predict or use the information we have about the bathymetry and individual wetlands, work out which ones are the best locations and which ones will hold water longest, and that will help protect fish and other aquatic animals during dry periods. We could also use the data that we've generated here to optimise depths in particular wetlands, and that will... specific depths are good for spawning for native fish species. And we can also make sure we've got water levels, for example, that are good for water birds, and maintaining them for long enough to produce a good recruitment event or a breeding event where they've got enough food from the water productivity to feed their chicks so that they can get to a fledging time. So having all of this information does enable us to plan things to fit with the ecosystem so that we are protecting Australia's native species as best we can with the water that we've got available.
That's Charles Sturt University Earth Science Professor Andrew Hall speaking there with Timmy King. It's 11 to 1 here on the Country Hour. So let's go to a farm in West Gippsland where you might have heard of a man known as the Steer Whisperer. Over the last 15 years, Anthony Willems, or the Steer Whisperer, has helped local producers raise some of Victoria's best bred cattle. Mr. Willems says he's always been drawn to agriculture.
My father was a dairy farmer, and I just loved it. I did a degree in horticulture, but always come back to agriculture. I worked at the Department of Agriculture at Ellenbank for a fair few years, and before I took on this role here at Lardner Park. Mm-hmm.
And locally, Anthony, you're known as the Steer Whisperer. So how did you earn that title?
I think growing up around cattle, loving them, owning them, working with them every day. And, I still milk cows on the side for some friends. So I just understanding them and being with them every day getting them to trust you and stuff like that takes time.
And how do you actually get them to trust you, and how do you understand them?
With these cattle here, I see them every day. I strip graze them and talk to them, and you know they get to know me. These cattle come from a range of different farms, so it does take time. It takes a month or two before they, you know, are used to what I drive, my whistle, my call. But it's just being around them really at the end of the day. And when we do yard them, you know, not pressuring them and stuff like that makes a big difference, and giving them time and space. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what else goes into raising a top-notch steer in your eyes, Anthony?
Probably starts with genetics, breeding, type, and then it comes down to what you're feeding them really at the end of the day, and how you're handling them, and the right nutrition.
And I've belled you up on a cold and wet day here in West Gippsland, Anthony. So how has your spring been so far?
We're probably one of the driest years on record up till about October, I think. We only had like 610 mil up till October, but I think we had over 100 mil in October, and November's, you know, heading that way as well. So we were very dry for us here for most of the year up until this point, and, you know, watering dams were still low and that sort of thing, and farmers were very nervous in the area because hay was all chewed up and stuff like that. But thankfully we've been getting this rain at the back end of spring, which has sort of been great for the farmers locally to be able to get plenty of silage off, and, you know, hay paddocks are growing and dams are filling.
Mm-hmm. And you've already got plenty of feed on the ground. It's looking pretty green here.
Yeah, we've got plenty of grass. I'm sort of looking at trying to do some silage myself. I'm probably understocked for what we do normally, but we run events as well, so it's a juggling act for me trying to run cattle and run events at the same time. I do a lot of mowing, you know, through our event space, and then there's, like, the cattle here at the moment are in what I call a car park paddock, and it's going to have, you know, thousands of festival goers here in a few weeks. So there's a quick change from chasing cattle to chasing people.
That's Anthony Willems, known as the Steer Whisperer. I won't whisper it again. He was speaking there to Faith Tavalian there. You're listening to The Country. Hey, just before we go to markets, there is a text on the line here saying, hey, it looks like the Yarram Sawmill could be reopening under new ownership by the looks of it. And then it sent me a link to the Pentark Group, which are different to AKD, which recently shut the Yarram Mill. A lot of jobs gone. We talked a lot about that extensively at the time. But the Pentark Group is advertising for a lot of jobs in the Yarram area, talking about a new program there, new opportunities there. So I don't know a lot about that. If anyone does, get in contact. 1300 977 222 is the number you can call. You can send a text 0467 842 722. But Pentark advertising a lot of jobs by the looks of it in Yarram, where they've just lost the sawmill there. So that might be something to keep an eye on. To markets, and we have a lot of markets to get through on a Tuesday. We'll start with the sheep and lamb market report coming out of Ballarat with Shiona Lamb. Wrong button. Try this one.
Good afternoon. Lamb numbers jumped to just over 30,000 penned. Quality improved across the yarding. However, there was a large portion of lambs showing dryness in their skins and starting to slip in condition. The market opened very strong over the big pens of light trade and store types to continue to be strong throughout the market. Light store lambs gained $5 to $14. Light and medium trade sold to 10 stronger. Heavy trade sold firm to 8 dearer. Heavy export lambs sold mostly firm, with some better sales throughout the market, ending to $6 dearer in places. Lambs back to the paddock sold from 104 to 232. Lambs to feed on sold 220 to $254 a head. Light and medium trade lambs made 210 to 268. Heavy trade sold 248 to 312, with a wide average range from 1100 to 1170 cents a kilo. Heavy export lambs, 26 to 30 kilos, made from 308 to 370, and the limited offering of over 30 kilo lambs sold 363 to 410 to average 1170 cents a kilo. There are still 9,000 sheep to be sold. This is Shiona Lamb at Ballarat for MLA.
Thanks very much for that, Shiona. Let's go to Lee and Gather Cattle. Brendan Fletch is there. G'day, Fletch.
G'day, Warwick. Numbers were similar at 2,140. That's 60 more. With an order rejoining the regular buyers in a cheaper market, quality declined with more secondary lots and cows representing over half of the sale. Trade cattle eased 10 to 20 cents on most sales. Bullocks lost 15 cents. Manufacturing steers slipped 20. Veal had sold from 440 to 492. Yearling trade steers 450 to 476. The heifer portion 420 to 470. Grown steers 452 to 480, bullocks 470 to 494. Heavy Frisian manufacturing steers 400 to 428, crossbreds 414 to 476. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA with over 1,000 cows and 100 bulls still to be sold.
Well, good luck with that, Brendan. Let's go to Shepparton Cattle Market. Nicole Varley has those details. Hi, Nicole.
Good afternoon. Well, we had 1,425 exports, of that 875 were cows. And we had 555 trade cattle offered at Shepparton. There was an excellent run of heavy beef cows offered. A few more faces were back at the rails this sale. However, that failed to stop the downward slide of prices across most of the export grades. Cows were 10 to 20 cents cheaper, more in some places. Grown steers and bullocks were also back. The trade cattle had greater numbers of vealers on hand. Quality was mixed with both prime and a store portion. Price trends varied. The best of the vealers made from 405 to 492 cents. Yearling steers to the trade made from 430 to 492 also. Yearling heifer portion 367 to 470. Heavy Frisian steers reached $4. The grown steers 400 to 500 kilos made to 495 cents. 5 to 600 kilo steers to 470. The bulk of the beef cows made from 372 to 415. And the heavy dairy cows 285 to 385 cents. This is Nicole Varley from Shepparton.
Thanks very much for that, Nicole. Lucky last in the market run today is Leanne Dax at Wodonga. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Numbers lifted to just over 2,300. Quality improved with plenty of well-finished yearlings and heavy cattle. A few more buyers made it to the sale. However, not all operated to capacity, particularly the export buyers. Demand weakened over all categories. Domestic and export processors were very selective, with feedlots stepping in and absorbing some of the better finished stock. Veal sold 20 cents cheaper, 413 to 468. Trade steers were back 5 to 10 cents, 410 to 468. Feeder steers slipped 24 cents, 440 to 462. Feeder heifers were back 10, $4 to 440. Heavy grown steers were down 20 cents, 432 to 475. Bullocks are unchanged, 435 to 464. Heavy heifers with a bit of shape were down 20 cents, $4 to 455. Heavy cows sold 10 cents cheaper, 396 to 432. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks very much for that, Leanne. If you're just joining us, we've got a bit of a mystery coming in on the text line. And I must admit, I don't know the ins and outs of the sawmill industry, even though it is a major primary industry in Victoria. Someone sent in the text saying it looks like the Yarram sawmill could be reopening. It was only about a month ago we were talking about it shutting, with AKD telling the 170 or so employees that they were going to shut the doors on that business. Someone sent us a link to Pentark, which is a different timber mill group, and they're advertising a number of jobs for a new venture at Yarram Sawmill, new business at the Yarram Sawmill. Administration support, team leader supervisor roles, trades roles, and Yarram Sawmill production roles. I'd be really keen on learning more about this. If you know more, you can give us a call, 1300 977 222. You can email us as well, countryhour@abc.net.au. countryhour@abc.net.au is our email, all one word. And I'm happy to read that and try and get into contact with you beyond that. Remember, the Country Hour is a podcast. You can listen back to this program or any programs to get a little bit more information. If you want to listen back to the Agriculture Minister from today or from a couple of days ago when we were looking at the delay to the Emergency Services and Volunteers levy or tax from the Victorian government. And if that's not enough for you, you can go online, abc.net.au/rurals, where you find all your rural news and information. And right now there's a story up there about how FarmSafe Australia is issuing a warning after two serious hay bale incidents, and a good reminder to be safe while you're out there. Stay safe so you can come back tomorrow and listen to the Country Hour. I'll be back with you then. Have a great afternoon. It's 1 o'clock right now.